Hello and welcome to another episode of Monday Mile, your walk and talk podcast, your source of moving motivation. This week we have a man that has probably got the best looking legs in West London. He's a Sunday Times best-selling author and he has hit the top of the podcast charts more times than I could count. He's outspoken yet charming and has one of the most successful online PT businesses in the world. James Smith, welcome to Monday Mile.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
What was your highlight out of that intro?
Probably the legs, if I'm honest. All fart, no poo. They're all for show. There's not much strength actually going on there. But yeah, I'm very fortunate to have lean legs. A lot of people in the fitness industry, they're like, six pack. My relationship to food won't permit that. So I was like, I'm just going to train my legs as much as I can.
To be fair, I feel your vibe.
Yeah.
I like a bit of leg myself.
Thick thighs save lives, that's what I say.
Exactly. Let's embrace it. Where are we today?
We are in the lovely Windsor, which is very close to where I grew up. I grew up between Windsor and Ascot, which is, it's a difficult one because then everyone thinks you're really posh and privileged.
I was going to say, quite posh, right?
Yeah, it is. It is pretty posh, yeah. It's a really nice part of the world and I was very fortunate to grow up here and it's a very nice place to come home and see my family.
You're just back from Australia. Are you here to stay? Are we going to keep you in the UK?
So I had to leave Australia as part of getting a permanent visa. So my goal is to get residency in Australia so I can live between the two. But when you apply for these permanent visas, you have to leave. So I had to leave as part of that. I hadn't seen my family in a while. COVID in Australia is very different here. They've got full nightclubs. There'll be hundreds of people queuing next to each other. I was just saying to you before we started recording, Queensland has had probably less than 10 deaths the whole of lockdown. Even New South Wales, the state in which I'm in, has only had a few hundred deaths.
We're still wearing masks over here. Actually, I think next week, all of that's supposed to stop. How have you found being back home, seeing the fam?
You've been on a little mission this morning. Tell us what that was.
So my sister's had a child since I've been away. So I've now got a nephew. I'm now an uncle. But I never even saw my sister pregnant. So it was very strange.
Wow.
My mum and dad being like, your sister's pregnant. And then she had the bump and then she had a baby. But it changed the dynamic of the car situation at home where my mum's got a Mini and my dad's got a Mini. So I went on the search for buying them like a 4x4, an SUV. And I bought them a Porsche this morning. So I was late for the podcast because I had to drive it up from Portsmouth and teach my dad how to use it.
We'll let you off for that. Just buying your dad a Porsche, is that to make up for the sort of terror that you caused them as a teenager growing up in the UK?
Do you know what? It's actually probably worse than people expect. I got asked to leave secondary school when I was 15. 15,
what?
16,
what,
yeah.
What did you do?
There was a mixture of things, really bad behaviour. I'm pretty sure I was bunking. Well, no, I was bunking a lesson. But to hide from the teachers, I was behind the stage in the school hall with another friend, about with the props that they used for drama. And my mate was sat on a sofa that had wheels on it and I've pushed him off the stage. He's grabbed the curtain to stop himself from going off. So the curtain's just gone ding, 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 breaking off the stage. And I look over and my head of year's over there. So I got called to my head of year office, which wasn't a bad thing. I'd been in there like most weeks. Even when I got sent to the headmaster's office, I'd sit in the toilet for 10 minutes, come back, have to put my best acting face on and go, yeah, I've been told to come get my belongings. And everyone in the class would be like, ooh. But I'd just get my backpack and go to the sweet shop. And then if I was leaving the school, the teachers would be like, where are you going? I'd be like, I've got the dentist. And then I'd come back and my friends would be like, oh, how bad are you in trouble? And the truth is, I hadn't been to the headmaster's. I hadn't been sent to get my stuff. And I would do this on rotation for years. It all caught up with me when I was 16. And when I went to my head of year, my mum was sat in there. I was like, oh, and they said, if you don't leave the school today, we're going to have to formally expel you.
So you got away with a couple of years of running rings around the teachers and...
Yeah, caught up with me.
So the Porsche is a form of repayment?
Yeah, pretty much. I was a terrible child. And do you know what? I probably didn't have much going for me until I was probably 25 when I started personal training business. It's the first time I've probably been passionate about anything in my life other than sport. It's been a good few years, but although business and everything goes quite well, I'm quite a simple person. I have a skateboard. I prefer having my skateboard for going around London. And yeah, my mum and dad were like, oh, we're going to get a car. I caught my dad on Auto Trader and I was like, I'll get this one.
Yes. that is amazing. So thinking back to the sort of journey you've been on with school, take us sort of right back to the start of your PT journey. You're in Australia, humping chunks of wood around. Do you think sort of the hours of graft on the gym floor, doing odd jobs, has created the resilience to create this multi-million pound machine that is the JSA? I'm calling it a multi-million pound machine. I don't know, but
it doesn't
take too much to work out.
Yeah, it goes all right. Yeah, but the fortunate thing is, even though my mum and dad are from a nice part of Berkshire, when I was 21, I remember saying to my dad, like, oh, I've run out of money, can I have some? And he sent me to the job centre in Gloucester, and he said to me to sign on the dole. And I was like, Dad, we're from Windsor, why are you making me sign on the dole? And he was like, well, I've paid enough tax in my years, you can sign on. And I was so mortified by it that I took my first job in door-to-door sales. So yeah, I ended up doing door-to-door sales, worked on a farm in New Zealand. I'd worked in shopping centres. You know the people that stop you when you're doing your shopping?
You literally do anything possible to walk past them, right?
Yeah. But then you learn the trade a bit, and it was a bit fun. I used to get £7 for a sale when I worked in a shopping centre. So we didn't get an hourly rate, we just got £7 for a sale. Say you get 10 people to sign up for a day, you're looking at £70 and you're knackered, and there's so much rejection that you get whilst you're doing it as well. But all of these things, and even boring marketing jobs, and I did a few desk jobs in my time, they kind of build you up to... Yeah, come a bit closer if you want. That engine's like excellent and loud.
Nice boat. I wouldn't mind sitting on that right now, yeah, in my bikini, cruising in Windsor.
Yeah, all of these jobs kind of set you up, and you can say you're kind of lucky, but if you learn from even jobs you don't enjoy, you can kind of apply that into what you're doing. And I mean, even learning how to send an email properly in recruitment really set me up for when I became a personal trainer. The gym I started in, for instance, had 2,500 members. And I went into the gym manager office, I knocked. I said, can I email the members? And he goes, well, they're only supposed to be notified about marketing. And I said, well, technically it is marketing. I pay you weekly rent. Can I just introduce myself? He was like, okay, go on then. So I emailed 2,500 members, blind carbon copied them on Gmail, so they didn't all think it was a group message. Yep. And I was up to 30 hours of PT in my first week.
Hi, I'm James Smith.
And it was like, and it wasn't even like PT with me costs this. I was like, I'll go for a soft sale. If you see me around the gym and you need help with anything, just reply to this email. If not, I hope you enjoy your training. So many inquiries for personal training from that. And I suppose I've been kind of savvy with everything since, because most personal trainers are only personal trainers because they look good.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the swimmer's body illusion?
No, I haven't. Please tell all.
Imagine someone's like really wanting to get in shape and they're looking at people from different sports.
Yep.
For some kind of, you know, motivation. They look at bodybuilders and they go, nah, they're too chunky. They look at runners, they go, nah, they're too skinny. And they look at swimmers and they go, that's the body I want. I want to have the body of a swimmer. So they start swimming. But a few months into swimming, they'd realize it's all an illusion. Swimmers don't look the way they look because they swim. They swim because of the way they look. So people that have got the physiques that are great for swimming end up becoming great swimmers. And a lot of people will say to me, oh, you're big and broad because you play rugby. And I'd say, no, I play rugby because I'm big and broad. So
right. You
get 100 guys to play rugby. The 15 guys who are the biggest and broadest, they're the ones that come away going, that was sick. I'm joining my local club. Then they're the ones that end up going up the hierarchies into academies and playing for England, where the skinny dudes who hated it end up going for jogs and they enjoy it because they don't fatigue over 10, 15 miles. So when you apply that into personal training, you have got a genetic subclass of people who don't have to work very hard to be in amazing shape. And what do their friends say to them?
You should be
a personal trainer. You should teach people how you do it.
So is this you?
No, not at all.
You couldn't be further from that because you had the legs but not the six-pack to roll with it.
And I was...
We've seen the six-pack though in the budgies. It does come out occasionally.
It can come out. But for me, like when I sat down with people and they like to overeat, I was like, so do I. They're like, you know, I don't know much about nutrition. I didn't. When I was at university, I was living off sausage rolls and cans of baked beans. I would literally be hungover at uni, open a can of baked beans and just eat it with a spoon. Like, I had no real understanding of what I should be eating. And then coming through my 20s and starting to lift weights and starting to eat better, the way my body was changing, I was like, how do you not get taught this? How have I been doing insanity workouts at university trying to get in shape when really eating more protein and going to the gym 3 times a week could do so much more? And like, my features changed in my 20s going into my 30s. My like composition changed.
Through your understanding of diet?
Quite literally. And then my girlfriends got so much hotter as the years went on. And that was like my biggest like...
They started at a 6 and now are they up in the 10s?
Oh, they started lower than that.
Oh, really?
So like, I then ended up going on this like mad pursuit of, I'm annoyed that I didn't know this. I'm frustrated that no one taught this to me. And I kind of thought, what I could have really done with when I was younger is someone turning up on my phone and going, wait, do this, stop doing that. That isn't what you should be doing. And people are very confused and they do need to be metaphorically slapped around a bit. And I kind of slotted into the position of being the person who I really could have been with having in my earlier 20s.
So from that, you're most famously known for essentially debunking diet culture. That, in a sense, has catapulted your career, but has it also got you in trouble?
Well, I'm quite careful with how I do it. Firstly, I'll only attack people who would never be my client in the first place. So if I go after vegans, doctors that are not even proper doctors, or washed-up celebrities from Geordie Shore, these are people that were never going to slip off their seat and attend my talks, buy my books, or join my academy. So I could be quite targeted with who I go after, and people go, oh, you know, is that bad for business? Well, no, it's not. It literally just cultivates your existing pool of prospects and grows it. And then the only thing you have to then watch out for is, from a legal standpoint, to ensure you're not slandering people. But as long as I can get across every point as a personal opinion, it can't be held as slander. So it can't be defamation. So in essence, I'm setting a light to loads of stuff and benefiting from it. So it's all a tactical ploy. No one has ever come up to me in real life with a problem.
Yeah.
And no one has ever successfully sued me for anything. So it is a bit more calculated than people might expect.
And very, very intelligent.
Yeah,
so it really is a fantastic business ploy.
I actually don't really like confrontation face to face. Like, I'm not a big fan of getting in kind of heated arguments or debates or anything like that. For me, it's like a bit like market research. So let's look at social media growth, or even just trying to treat your social media like a game. I gamify a lot of things in my life.
Yeah.
And when it comes to market research, I always say men have been very assumptive over what women like sexually. And often men, in especially a sexual setting, don't often have the audacity to just ask a woman and say, hey, what do you like? For instance, some women like penetration, some women like clitoral stimulation. And you can waste a lot of time and effort going for the wrong one if there's not enough communication between the two. And often, for there to be successful market research implemented, you need to know how the person you're with responds the best. So I treat my social media kind of similar to that, where I could try 5 different tactics of posting something. Okay, this one is where I'm brutally honest. This one's where I throw myself under the bus. This one is where I'm sycophantic and I'm intentionally trying to cause a big ruckus for personal gain. And the 5th one is a really genuine post. I can then look at the engagement, the reactions, the website clicks, the follows. I can look at all of these metrics and then learn over time what my audience want, when they want, how they react to it. So based off what I need for my platform at the time, I can create a themed post. And it's also a bit like hot and cold as well. If I go too far leaning to the side of, you know, setting a light to things and calling people out, I then need to come back in with something a bit more empathetic or something a bit more understanding, something a bit more educative. So the whole time with all of this stuff, if there's ever a lot of heat surrounding a subject or a topic, it's often because I've created it intentionally.
So it's kind of one extreme to the other. Do you find you go far left, 5, and then have to come back in and cradle your audience with a 1?
100%.
But that is a genius. I'm pretty sure there is no other, if you like to say, PT, tailoring their content to their audience quite like that.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting game. And sometimes people will say to me like, oh, but you're not doing this, you're not doing that. Ultimately, my main objective of social media is to take email addresses from them.
Yeah.
And everyone says, oh, you know, what if this, what if that? And I say to them, so many people lose sight of how to run a business in the grand scheme of just trying to be famous. For me, the only reason I have so many followers and the blue tick and cross so many platforms is because of my tenacity to obtain their contact information. I would much rather have 500,000 email addresses than 500,000 followers, because a lot of people, they completely forget that social media is talking to someone in the busiest nightclub there is.
Yeah.
When really, if there's a woman that I really want to go for a date with, I'm not going to spend the night with her and not my friends. I'm going to go over and say, hey, give me a number so I can text you tomorrow. Cool. Take the number, go away. And so many people are missing this game on social media of collecting contact information from people.
Yeah, everyone's fighting currently in the same pond.
People come off Love Island. They take all of these posts from Boohoo and all of this. I go, mate, the f***ing day you come out, give something away for free in return for people's email addresses.
Genius.
Yeah, and they don't do it. I actually met Adam Collard for a coffee when he came out of Love Island. And he was thinking of doing something. And I said something to him similar. I go, all these people just want to milk you. You should be milking your following whilst you can do it. And so many people still don't understand how social media works.
And has he done that?
Nah, not as far as I know. Not as far as I know. Sorry, Adam.
You heard it here. Talking about your sort of outlandish and outspoken charisma, do you have any role models that you look up to? I noticed you were on GMB with Piers Morgan. For someone like that to almost take you under his wing and support what you're doing must have been quite a triumph.
It was, but at the same time, I completely understood Piers and Susanna Reid's motive before we went. They wanted me to fat shame them, and I flipped it when I got there. So I, in the response to GMB, agreed to fat shame them on TV.
Unreal.
And then I waited till I was live and threw Joe Wicks under the bus instead. And even when I had to fly back from Ireland. I was book signing in Ireland.
You were in Belfast?
Yeah, I was over.
My home, original home.
Oh, don't tell too many people that. I'm joking. So I had to come back. And while I was coming back, I was like, I was thinking of all the ways that Susanna Reid and Piers are going to try and throw me under the bus tomorrow. Not in a bad way. It wasn't like they wanted to ruin me or make me look like these idiots that appear on TV. But I kind of was already media trained. So when Susanna says to me, do you think Piers is fat? They wanted me to go, yeah, he is. Oh, yeah, calorie deficit. And I just kind of nullified it by saying, oh, it's not the first thing I thought of when I walked in today. And it was very good for me to walk away from GMB with my own agenda. Now, I'm a fan of Piers Morgan. I think he's one of the few people left that speaks his mind. But when it comes to role models, and I haven't really told many people this, Joe Rogan, right, has
yes.
shown the world that if you do something consistently every day, you can master it. And I'm not talking about the black belts he holds in martial arts. His first podcasts were embarrassing. And he literally, over time, just kept going and going and going and going. And he didn't really gain traction until 7 or 8 years into his podcast. And
that is a really, really, really long time. And there's so much, I think, that people don't understand about podcasting, books, creating content that goes into the back end of making it a success.
People now are like, oh, why aren't Spotify interested in my podcast? Russell Kane did a very good post the other day saying about how people want to be a stand-up comedian, but they don't want to go work in clubs for free 5 times a week for 3 years before they ever get invited to anything. And my first year on social media, I was still very much the same person you're walking with now. I posted every day, at least twice for a year, I got 800 followers. In my second year, I got 1,200 more. So in 2 years of posting over twice a day, I got 2,000 followers. And my rugby teammates used to rip the shit out of me because I'd post about carbohydrates. They'd be like, oh, Smithy, can we eat carbohydrates? And again, it took me years until I ever got any traction. I never made money back from a post until probably my fourth year of posting. And that's when I sold like a plan to someone. But I was willing when I started it to do it for 10 years if I needed to, because I appreciated that the people that are at the top of their kind of mastery, like Joe Rogan, they would have had that exact same mindset. And so many people lack that now because things happen so quick. You can get something off Amazon Prime the next day.
People ordered a fan last night.
Yeah, people completely overlook the integral parts of success, which is more often than not consistency and accepting that you're going to be bad at first. Like, Joe Rogan's first podcast was on the front camera of his computer while he was with his mate. I'm pretty sure it was Eddie Bravo sat next to him while they were just talking.
Back when webcams were blurry and probably couldn't record audio to the same
quality
of today. And now
he's smoking with Elon Musk for the second time, you know, from his studio, you get paid $100 million from Spotify. People see that, they're like, oh my God, I need to start a podcast. But if you said to them they'd have to work for 10 years to do it, they wouldn't be interested.
No, that is wild. And you're clearly not afraid of putting in a little bit of graft. How do you now manage, JSA, the continuous repetition of CFD? What does that mean for those that may or may not already know?
Calorie f***ing deficit. Like,
you hammer it, absolutely hammer it home. But every single time I've digested that content myself, you seem to manage to put a slightly different tweak or angle on it. How do you stay motivated to essentially keep regurgitating that same message?
So everyone asks me if I get bored of repeating myself, but people need to realize I repeat myself so much less now than I used to. So let's say I would train 30 sessions a week with 10 to 15 clients. On top of that, I'd probably be getting 2 to 3 new clients in every week, even for a trial session. So even when I had a trial session, someone that I was taking for an hour to try and sell to them my services, I would have to use the same sales speech, the same, like, can you squat? Can you hip hinge? Can you do this? I had to repeat the same cues so many times. Even before I went online, I conducted over 5,000 hours of PT. So I am a master of repeating myself. I have had the same conversations with similar people 1,000 times over. I've had to produce the same personal training sessions, the same cues with a squat. I've had to teach so many people how to load their hamstrings when they lean forward. For me to produce a one single video every day is nothing. It takes me 20 minutes compared to the hours that I was spending on the floor doing it. And I was, when I was working on the floor, I wasn't like, well, I'm gonna go blue tick and get away from this. I was like, this is me for the next 40 years. So I was expecting to do this for another 30 years. So to be able to be in a position where I do a lot less in comparison now, it really is no effort.
So tell us a little bit more about the JSA and how many subscribers you have. That position you have must be almost addictive in the sense that your clients are coming back time after time and you're changing their lives. That must be like a really good feeling.
The best thing is that for my whole life, I've been restricted as a PT where 10 a.m. Tuesday, I can only train one person. 4 p.m. on a Friday, I can only train one person. Like, I'd only be restricted. So if I had two people that wanted to train after work on a Friday, I could only help one. So now I've created an app and a system where I can help hundreds of people wherever they are in the world at the same time, because that conversation I'd have with them in the gym, I've recorded and put online for them. And the best bit is I can now charge them a fraction. So when I finished PTing on the floor, I was charging about £55 an hour. Now people can pay £40 for a month. And with that, not only do they get access, I've now hired coaches that I've worked with before, and they now are available 24/7 to rotate programs, chat to people. I pay the coaches on interaction. So now my old PT manager from Fitness First is now my head coach in my academy, and he's in Australia. I go for dinner with him several times a month or whatever. And now instead of him being in a gym, he's got a young daughter as well. Every time his daughter goes to preschool or his daughter's with his other partner or he goes to a cafe and opens his laptop, he can work remotely. I've had other friends who have gone traveling and I've said, hey, why don't you coach for me? Because they're personal trainers. So it's amazing now that I can support my friends who are coaches. They can support me with my business and I can support thousands of clients at a time with their endeavors that they want to do. And whether I'm busy writing a book, being on tour or whatever, the level of service never really changes, where before I was very limited with what I could give people. And now there's kind of structure in place to give more for less. I'm very fortunate to have such a big client base as well.
It is mad. You have changed the face of the online PT game alongside all of your other accolades, Sunday Times bestseller, top of the charts podcast host. How have you managed to keep both feet on the ground? Working on the gym floor must seem like a lifetime ago.
Well, do you know what? I think Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu has really helped. Every week without fail, someone will beat the out of me. Like, beat the out of me. And there's that level of humility where when I go to training, I'm still with my teammates wiping sweat off the mats. Like, a lot of people take their profession and they use that to really show people who they are. But for me, my work is my work. And, you know, when I'm with my friends, I'm still the friend as before. When I'm at training, I'm just a purple belt. I'm no better than the next guy. There could be a janitor, for all I care, who's a belt above.
Yeah.
He's going to line up above me. I'm going to, you know, let him go first if we're partnered up together. Like, there are so many parts of my life. When I go home to my family, although I made a nice gesture for them this morning, they much rather want their son home for a roast dinner than they do having a child buy him a Porsche, you know? So life is still very normal for me. I still skateboard, and a lot of the lavish purchases that I can afford now, they don't change who you are as a person. And I would, the people closest to me would tell me if I was changing for the wrong.
Yeah.
And they'd say, James, mate, stop being a
That is brilliant. So martial arts, is that a big part of your life now in helping you sort of maintain your own physical fitness as well as juggling everything else?
Yeah, and it's somewhere where when I go to training, there's no phones on the mats. There's no egos will survive in martial arts because people will beat it out of you. And it's so nice to have something that I focus on and give equal importance to my work. Because have you ever had friends that the most important thing in their life is their partner, and then when they break up, they're like they're rock bottom.
Yeah.
Because they put all their eggs in that basket. Whereas for me, I have eggs in my basket of work, I have eggs in my basket of martial arts, I have eggs in my basket of relationship with friends and family. So that if the tabloids ruin me tomorrow and I get cancelled, I've still got jiu-jitsu. And I might be the guy that used to be a successful personal trainer. I might be back on the floor doing sessions for 20 quid, but I've still got my purple belt, I've still got martial arts. So if the internet goes down tomorrow and I no longer become relevant and no one gives a who I am anymore, which will happen one day, I can open up a gym near the beach somewhere in Australia and just teach martial arts till the day I die. And having that as something that I can lean back on, I think is more valuable than any amount of money or fame that you can get in the process of doing it.
That sounds like the absolute dream. Imagine just kicking back, retiring in Australia, getting the budgies on, going for the morning swim.
Having a little dojo. And if I need to get my memberships up, I'll just go door to door knocking. It'll be easier to sell than gas and electric.
On your skateboard, right?
Yeah, wearing my kimono at the same time. I'll be there with my belt tied up. Hi, my name's James Smith. I used to be that famous PT. Do you want to come join at my gym?
But my question is, you've lived in Australia. Can you surf because you skate?
I'm very, very bad at surfing. Like, so, funnily enough, this ties in with jiu-jitsu. Do you know the difference in gi and no-gi?
I actually don't have a clue. Tell us.
Okay, so there's the one sport, which is Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yep.
You either wear a kimono, which is like the little pyjama outfit to the training, and you have your coloured belt.
I see you in blue sometimes.
Yeah, you can wear whatever colour you like, permitting on your gym.
Did you go hot pink?
There are girls that wear pink. I don't think I'd get away with that. You start as a white belt, then blue, then purple, then brown, then black. 2 years a belt, minimum. So like it takes a lot of time studying. And then we have no gi, where you wear a rash guard and shorts. So the girls wear leggings. In gi, you can grab clothing and use the clothing to choke people.
Yep.
But in no gi, you can't. So where a lot of people assume if you can skateboard, you can surf, it's only one way. Surfers can skate, but skaters can't surf. People that do gi can do no gi, but people that do no gi don't know how to do gi.
Is that your justification for not being able to surf?
Pretty much, yeah.
Because that's a really average excuse.
There's also a lot of sharks. No, Jake.
You know what, actually? I've been to Australia. So one of my best friends is an Australian snowboarder. She won the Olympics in 2010. Bit of a legend. Fresh. And she had a flat in Bondi. So every time we were snowboarding in Australia, we'd do a little swing by on the way back. And they would all surf. And I love the water, but I'd literally just sit on the beach. I'm terrified of sharks.
There's, even if there aren't many shark attacks, they have a drone that goes around the beaches, and the drone shows you all the great whites that are kicking about the beach. And you got people swimming all amongst the sea and everything. And you can see them from how far you would have been from swimming with a great white.
That's absolutely terrifying.
Do you like Bondi?
I absolutely love Bondi. It's I've been there probably like five times, and I go out of my way every single time I'm in the Southern Hemisphere to spend a few days there, because that place is just magic. Waking up, everyone gets up at like 5:30 in the morning, get your exercise done, have a banging breakfast, and it's just...
That's pretty much the
life. It's the dream. It gives me like goosebumps. I think I'd like to live there as well.
It's where I think I want to have kids as well. So if I should meet a woman in my dreams and we end up having kids, I'd like to bring them up there, chuck them in the sea every morning, have my wife complain at me for bringing the kids in sandy. I've already got it all pictured.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty good lifestyle. I'd take that on. Just need to find myself an Australian husband.
Boy, it's tough. Australian men have got chat.
Really?
Well, the majority of them.
I actually don't know many Australian men.
Yeah, for that reason.
Yeah, there we go. Point proven. Every week on Monday Mile, we like to ask our guest about their relationship, not with a woman, but the start of the week, Monday. What's the vibe? Does it excite you?
I love Mondays. I say to people that Mondays never suck, but sometimes your life does. And if people want to, you know, people forget that we are the architects of our life and we construct every element of it. People just sometimes fail to think that and remember that, and they let other people construct their lives. And I mean, even people that work for the man versus self-employed, and this doesn't mean you can't be happy and employed, but when people go into an employed model, someone gives them the least amount of money for the most amount of work, and they wonder why they feel like they haven't got energy, passion, drive, or charisma in everyday life. And I'm not surprised if someone's doing that and giving you the worst deal possible. Like, being able to wear jeans on a Friday and people saying they work for a good employer because of that. There are so many people that don't enjoy Monday because they're living someone else's construct. And yeah. I think that the most kind of empowering thing for people is every element and jigsaw piece of your life you're in control of, people just forget that. And they're kind of bred that way by the powers that be so that they remain in these jobs so someone does them.
Give you a little fist pump for the self-employed life.
Yeah, you like that.
Roaming around Windsor in the sun.
But this is it. And I mean, the thing is, again, people need to move away from this construct of more money, more happiness, when if you're earning less money, but you're chasing something you're passionate about, you're doing something you enjoy, and you're constructing every part of it, your wins are going to feel so much better than, you know, go to the city on a Thursday night in London. There are so many young guys wearing £1,000 suits, snorting away the week's worth of up their nose, and, you know, then having to spend time with a family they didn't really want to have in the first place so they can then go back to work on a Monday.
No, it's actually just sad. And yeah. You can only hope for people that are stuck within that system, you know, doing those drugs, that they can find a better outlook, whether it's getting outside more or...
Yeah, and just constructing their life differently. And you don't have to do it to appease other people or to do what everyone else is doing. And like, going to Australia was great because I realised there are some people that work in cafes that are 25, their parents say they need to get a real job, they make coffees from 6 a.m. till 2 p.m, they clock off, they meet their friends to watch the sun go down at the beach with a couple of ciders in the evening, walk the neighbour's dog, and they've got a better life than 75% of people on the planet.
Yeah, too true. And James, lastly, we like to ask every guest on Monday Mile if they've got any takeaways for our listeners.
So where the head goes, the body will follow. So rather than people just focusing on their body, just focus on sit-ups and abs and forced workouts, think on changing who they are, whether it's getting a step count. If they hit a step count every day, they can look back and go, I'm an active person. If they get a gym membership, it's that you are a gym goer. You are someone who lifts weights. You are a fitness person. Oh, you're into fitness? Yeah, I am. You know, it's all about these like identity changes. Again, when people say, you go off booze for a while, say you're gonna have 6 months to sort your life out. Instead of saying, oh, I've given up drink, just say to people, oh, I don't actually drink. You know, the way we talk to ourselves, the way we conduct ourselves, and the way we portray our own identity, if people can have a real harsh look at who they are and who they want to be, the body will take care of itself.
Love that. James Smith, thank you so much for joining us here on the Monday Mile Walk and Talk podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And to you guys, thank you for listening. If you are new to the podcast, please do subscribe and leave us a little rating. We're dropping the visual highlights of our walk on Instagram and TikTok. So do have a little gander. That's at Amy_Fuller. Hope you enjoyed walking with us. We will be dropping a new episode each week, Monday morning. It's early, early for those listening in on the audio, and at 8:30. On Instagram. So check back next week. It is a wrap from us. Have an absolutely wicked week.